K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes. Well, I want to talk about a documentary that has been nominated for Best Documentary for the Oscars that are happening on Sunday. But before I do, you know, talking about, because it's on Hulu streaming and TV, I was like just really taken back with the firing of Joy Reid from MSNBC, just an incredible woman of color who isn't afraid to say what must be said. Just, you know, right there, if I didn't watch anything else, I'd listen to Joy. I really appreciated her. And MSNBC got a new manager, and they not only got rid of Joy Reid, Alex Wagner, another person of color, the Moyhan guy, Katie Fang. I mean, all the people of color. Bye bye. And on Monday night, Rachel Maddow just really went off about the whole thing on her show. I took guts. So now she's still on MSNBC, but late last night, early this morning, they told her, bye-bye, your whole crew's gone. You can keep your producer, your executive producer, a couple of people, but her whole team, bye-bye. And they did the same thing to the Latino man that's on in the morning time. Oh, bye-bye. Although, wow. Bowing down to the king, Lester Holt, quit. Another person of color. I don't know how this society is going to keep going if you try to deny the people of color that are all around you. Because we're all human beings. I am no better than anybody out there. And nobody is better than me. We're all equal. We're born as human beings the same. And there's a reason why the Creator made white people and black people and red people and yellow people and brown people. Didn't make just one color. And each and every one has something to contribute to make this world a better place. We were given this beautiful Mother Earth. And it's been white man that has been the leader of the destruction. Yes, I want to talk about the Oscar-nominated documentary, which exposes the truth about, the Indian residential schools. And let me tell you, I watched it, and it's quite gut-wrenching, to say the least. But the discovery of the hundreds of unmarked graves at an Indian residential school in Canada in 2021 was just the catalyst for the movie Sugarcane. The discovery of the hundreds of unmarked graves at an Indian residential school in Canada in 2021, again, was just the catalyst for Sugarcane. Julian Brave, Noise Cat, and Emily Cassie, the filmmakers behind the Oscar-nominated documentary, spent years investigating the truth behind just one of the institutions. Sugarcane, now streaming on Hulu, paints a horrifying picture of the systematic abuses inflicted by the state-funded school and exposes for the first time a pattern of infanticide and babies born to Indigenous girls and fathered by priests. In the years since it debuted at the Sundance Film Festival, Sugarcane has screened at the White House, for Canadian Parliament, and for over a dozen Indigenous communities in North America, sparking a grassroots movement and reckoning to find the truth about the other schools. It also marks the first time that an Indigenous Northern American filmmaker has received an Oscar nomination. From the 19th century until the 1970s, more than 150,000 First Nation children were required to attend state-funded Christian schools as part of a program to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were forced to convert to Christianity and not allowed to speak their native languages. Many were beaten and verbally abused, and up to 6,000 are said to have died. Nearly three-quarters of the 130 residential schools were run by Roman Catholic missionary congregations. Canada's residential schools were based on similar facilities in the United States, where Catholic and Protestant denominations operated more than 150 boarding schools between the 19th and 20th centuries, according to researchers, that also were home to rampant abuse. Quote, "It's too often that we look everywhere else in the world to horrors and abuses happening, and that's important," said Native. "But Native issues are rarely the issue of the day, and we believe that they deserve to be," Cassie said. Quote, "This story is the genocide that happened across North America, and we've never grappled with it. Native people have rarely been the focal point of that kind of countrywide dialogue. We hope that sugarcane helps to change that." As an investigative journalist and documentarian, Cassie has spent a decade making films about human rights abuses all over the world, from Afghanistan to Niger, but she'd never turned her lens to her own country. When the news broke about the unmarked graves, she felt drawn to the story and reached out to Noisecat to see if he wanted to help. They had become friends as cub reporters in New York who just happened to share neighboring desks. Quote, "In the years since, Julian had gone on to become an incredible writer and thinker and journalist focusing on indigenous life in North America. It felt like the natural fit," she said. While he was mulling it over, she went looking for a group to focus on and landed on St. Joseph's Mission near the sugarcane reservation of Williams Lake in British Columbia. Unbeknownst to her, that was the school Noisecat's family attended. He'd heard stories about his father being born nearby and found in a dumpster. Over the course of making the film, they discovered that he was actually born in a dormitory and found in the school's incinerator. Quote, "It was a process for me to ultimately, you know, if you didn't catch what I said, you know," and this is just one thing that they did at the school, and I'm sure it's going to talk more about this, but, you know, the babies that were born to the, you know, indigenous girls who were raped by the priest, well, once the babies were born, they would just throw them in the incinerator. And just by luck, with Noisecat's dad, they had left it right by the incinerator but hadn't put it in yet when a janitor came by, and he was unaware what was going on. He said, "Oh my gosh, this baby. And so, of course, they acted like they didn't know what was going on. They knew who the mother was, and she had to go to jail, you know, so... But I'll continue. Quote, "It was a process for me to ultimately decide to tell the story in a personal and familial way," said Noisecat, who during the making of the film lived with his father for the first time since he was around 6 years old. Quote, "It became very clear that he had had these unaddressed questions from his birth and upbringing, and that I was in a position to help him ask those questions, and in doing so, to address some of my own enduring pains and complications from his abandonment of me," Noisecat said. Quote, "The big thing, though, was going to the Vatican with the late Chief Rick Gilbert and witnessing his incredible bravery. We've just been incredibly fortunate that this film has had real impact," Noisecat said. Quote, "I was really scared that telling such a personal and sometimes painful story might be a harmful thing, but really, thankfully, it's been a healing thing, not just for my family and our participants, but for Indian country more broadly." Over the last year, as the film has played at various festivals and for Indigenous communities on reservations, Cassie said that more survivors would have been coming forward with their stories. In October, former President Joe Biden also formally apologized to Native Americans for the, quote, "sin of a government-run boarding school system that for decades forcibly separated children from their parents," calling it a, quote, "blot on American history." Quote, "This is the origin story of North America," Cassie said. Quote, "It's a story of how the land was taken by separating six generations of kids, indigenous kids, from their families. And most people... most people don't know. Cassie noted that while sugarcane is inspiring conversations within communities, it comes at a political moment where governments are not actively supporting continued investigation and accountability. In a film industry with deep roots in the Western genre and problematic, racist depictions of Native Americans as impediments to westward expansion, authentic representation of indigenous stories on screen is still in the early days. In 97 years of the Oscars, no Native American person has ever won a competitive prize. Acting prize. Lily Gladstone, who is an executive producer on Sugar King, was, quote, passed over last year for Best Actress. And when the Oscar nomination came through for Sugar King, they made sure they had their facts right before touting it its own historic nature. Noise Cat was indeed the first indigenous North American filmmaker to get one. Quote, it's really special, he said, and at the same time, it's kind of shocking. Quote, we hope the film shows that there's still so much about this foundational story in North America that needs to be known and therefore needs to be investigated, Noise Cat said. This film should be seen not as an ending, but a beginning to a real grappling with this story. He added, more broadly, there are so many painful, important, beautiful, and sometimes even triumphant stories that come from Native people that come from Indian country. It's my hope that more Native stories and storytellers and films get recognized moving forward and get made. If Sugar Cane is named the winner at the Oscars on March 2nd, Noise Cat promised it will be an acceptance speech to watch. Quote, we will make it a moment, Noise Cat said. If we win, I'm going to get up there. I'm going to say something and we're going to do it well, too. And I want to thank Lindsay Bauer for that. And also from Native News Online, also a story about it. With the 2025 Oscar nominations of Sugar Cane in the documentary film category, the horrific story of Indian residential schools continues to garner more attention. Directed by 31-year-old Julian Brave Noise Cat of the Camim Lake Band, Tesquin Nation and Emily Cassie, Sugarcane sheds light on the missing children who never returned home, the survivors who carry the scars of the past and the ongoing fight for truth and reconciliation. Noise Cat is a Native writer, journalist, policy analyst, and activist, focuses on indigenous rights, climate policy, and social justice. He has written for major publications like the New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Guardian, covering issues related to indigenous communities, environmental justice, and progressive policies. Last year's Best Actress nominee, Lily Gladstone from the Blackfeet and Nez Perce Nations, is an executive producer of Sugar Cane. The movie focuses on St. Joseph's Mission Residential School in British Columbia, located near the Sugarcane Indian Reserve. The film follows the story of 12-year-old Mason, a former student, while also exploring the broader history of residential schools, institutions designed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children through abusive and dehumanizing conditions. The film also explores Noise Cat's personal connection to St. Joseph's Mission, where his father was both born and attended as a child. And through this deeply personal lens, the documentary captures the intergenerational trauma experienced by Indigenous families, while also chronicling the community-led movement toward reckoning and healing. Additionally, it documents the self-reflection of Rickard Gilbert, the former chief of the Williams Lake First Nation, who was part of a delegation of Indigenous leaders and residential school survivors who traveled to the Vatican in 2022 to meet with Pope Francis. That visit culminated in Pope Francis's public apology for the atrocities committed by Christian institutions against the Indigenous peoples in Canada. The origins of sugarcane trace back to 2021 when the discovery of the 215 unmarked graves at the Kalups Indian Residential School in British Columbia ignited a global conversation about Canada's residential school legacy. In late 2021, Williams Lake First Nation launched a 9-month investigation into potential unmarked graves at St. Joseph's Mission. The findings, announced by Chief Willie Sellers in January of 2022, reveal the possible burial sites of at least 50 Indigenous children. St. Joseph's Mission operated from 1891 to 1981 and was run by various religious sects under the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. And despite longstanding reports of neglect and abuse at the institution, many accounts were ignored or deliberately destroyed. One of the most harrowing stories revealed that 9 children attempted mass suicide by ingesting poison hemlock to escape the school. 1 did not survive. Additionally, several clergy members from St. Joseph's Mission were later convicted of sexual crimes against children in the 1990s. And before earning its Oscar nomination, Sugarcane garnered significant acclaim at major film festivals. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2024, where it received widespread praise for its compelling storytelling and meticulous research. The documentary was also featured at Sundance, where it won the Directing Award for U.S. Documentary. Beyond its artistic and cinematic achievements, the documentary has sparked important conversations about government and church accountability, pushing for justice and reparations for survivors and their family. Sugarcane is now available for streaming on Hulu and Disney Plus. Well, there's an election to happen soon in Ecuador, which is my home. And there's 2 candidates who are vying for the presidency, and it's like a second round, runoff. And both those candidates have never bothered to campaign at all in the indigenous communities, and there are many. Ecuador is known to be the most indigenous country in the world, with 51% of the population indigenous people, and the other 49% are half indigenous and half Latino. I know my roots. But I've had this one story that I've been wanting to share. I think it came out like maybe the early last summer sometime in The Guardian. I thought, I might just save that for Women's History Month. But I thought I'd share it today because I just feel it's important for this message. When Nemonte Nenquimo was a young girl, experience began to reinforce what she had come to know intuitively, that her life and those of the Warani people of Ecuador's Amazon rainforest were on a collision course with forces it would take all their strength and determination to resist. Quote, deep down, I understood there were 2 worlds, she remembers, in We Will Not Be Saved, the book she has written with her husband and partner in activism, Mitch Anderson. Quote, one where there was our smoky, fire-lit oko, where my mouth turned manioc into honey. The parrots echoed, Men Guatome, and my family called me Nemonte, my true name meaning many stars. And another world where the white people watched us from the sky. The devil's heart was black. There was something named an, quote, oil company, and the evangelicals called me Inez. In 2015, Nenquimo, now 39, co-founded the Cibo Alliance, a nonprofit organization in which she united with members of the Acofan, Secopani, and Siona people of Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia to fight for the rights over their territories. And those were all the people that I stayed with when I was when I went out to the rainforest with when my daughter was only about 13 or so. And we went to Ecuador, and we went into the rainforest there. And, we hung out with the Sequoia people, the Wairani, the Cofan. In fact, there was a young man there. His name is Randy Borman, and he just passed on to the spirit world last week. His parents were missionaries, but he just related with the Cofani people. He basically became one of them. But then after, he became, a teen at 18, 19, his family said, you got to go back to Michigan. And he stayed there just, a few months and said, no, I belong in the Cofani rainforest, where he really tried to protect the area, married a Cofani woman. And his son now has taken on a lot of the responsibilities that his father had. I just had to say something about Randy. All right. Well, since then, she has won numerous awards for her activism, including the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize. She was featured in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World in 2020 and has been named United Nations Champion of the Earth. Even more significantly, she's played a leading role in key political victories. In 2019, she took the Ecuadorian government to court to prevent it from auctioning 500,000 acres of land to the oil industry and won. And just last year, she campaigned in a successful referendum to protect the country's Yasuni National Park from drilling. And although women have long been decision makers in her community, she is the first to be chosen to lead the Wairani people of the Patanza Province. Her commitment and her triumph have also attracted attention from actors such as Leonardo DiCaprio, now a friend, and Emma Thompson, who provides an endorsement for her book. We talk on Zoom with, and this is again from The Guardian, we talk on Zoom with Anderson translating from the Spanish that Nemquimo learned as a second language when she left the settlement of Nemompare at 14 to live in a religious mission upriver in Quito. Her relocation to Ecuador's capital was a brutal wrenching that has brought that is brought vividly and horrifically to life in the book. Quote, not another pregnant jungle girl, says one of the mission staff, a woman, when she arrives. Nemquimo was not, in fact, pregnant, and she speaks of being subjected to repeated sexual abuse while she was at the mission. How does she feel now about those religious zealots, not least Rachel Saint, the American missionary who lived in Nepomper throughout Nemquimo's childhood, distributing sweets, dolls, bouncing balls, and dresses in return for attendance at church services? The first thing she tried to understand, she replies, is that these women came from very different cultures, quote, and they saw my people as people that weren't wearing clothes, that didn't write, didn't read, didn't know about the God who died on the cross. And deep down, Rachel Saint surely was convinced that she was on God's path and that her mission was to steer us away from the devil and the devil's ways. What Rachel Saint didn't understand and didn't care to understand was us, who we are, our identity, our history, our culture, our relationship to the earth. She mothered us immediately and thought she could save us and protect us. And in doing so, she weakened us and damaged us and hurt us profoundly. Much of Nemquimo's life, she explains, has been a process of grappling with that deception, not merely that one of the, quote, evangelical, but of all those Kowarani outsiders who arrived on small planes and in helicopters and referred to her people as Onkas or savages. Frequently, the god the missionary sought to impose on the Wairani was invoked as supportive of the oil industry, and those who disagreed were, quote, communists, including Amo, a young Wairani man, warning that the contamination of the rivers would lead to the death of their fish, a primary source of food. Quote, what will happen when all the fish are gone? Asked the child, Nemonte. Quote, then we will become like the Kowari, he answers. We will only eat chicken and rice, and we won't be funny. We'll never make jokes again. Not long after that, Amo was found shot dead. In an intensely moving scene, Nemquimo describes his parents refusing to allow him to be buried near the church and his father throwing money into his grave. Quote, this is why you're dead, my son. Money. Take it with you. This is the first book of its kind written by a member of the Wairani people, and it was vital to Nemquimo that, contrary to the experience of being seen through the lens of intrusive missionaries, company executives, and anthropologists, her community are allowed to speak on their own terms. Before writing it, she asked for permission and advice from her parents and other elders. She reproduces her father's words in the introduction, quote, walk down the trail, then veer off into the forest, leaving no tracks, which she took as an injunction to remember that the world outside is often not to be trusted. The life of hunting and gathering that has sustained the Wairani people is captured in minute and impressive detail. The making of poison-tipped blow darts for catching fish, the tracking of wild peccary pigs, and the cultivation of fruits and vegetables in her mother Manuela's extensive gardens. The rainforest is seen throughout as a source of sustenance and as a complex ecosystem that must be respected and safeguarded. I asked Nkwema what, given the encroachment of the outside world among all the Amazonian indigenous nations, their freedom would look like now. She replies that it continues to mean her people, quote, living in a vast and healthy forest and being in connection with that forest. So it means knowing how to go to the river and fish and bring food home for your family. It means going out as a family and making gardens and knowing you're going to be harvesting several moons down the line. It means knowing how to identify the sources of sickness and then find medicinal plants in the forest, roots, resins, vines, barks, to cure ourselves. It means being self-sufficient in the forest and to our villages and being able to make decisions as a people to continue to live happily and healthy existences in our land. That freedom has for many decades been in severe jeopardy, as Nkwema points out. Quote, we're surrounded by oil companies, miners, evangelicals, and an entire global economy that promotes consumerism, promotes accumulation of things and products. She sees her campaigning work, of which this book is an extension, as a call to action. Quote, that's why I want the oil company executives and the chiefs of industry to read this book, to read my story, because one of these things that our elders say is that the less you know about something, the more easy it is to destroy it. And that's also what's happening in the world with oil companies and mining companies. They don't truly and deeply understand the land, the forest, the ecosystem, and how it is providing life to all of us, and how interconnected all of us are across the globe. I want investors and financial institutions and the ones that are making decisions about where the money flows, I want them to read the book and this story. I want to talk with them. If they do, they will discover an account that is both rich in powerful personal detail and scathing about the oil industry's indifference to the lives and lands it regards as ripe for exploitation and profit. We Will Not Be Saved is presented in two halves. The first recounts Nkwema's childhood and her removal to the mission. The second, after she left the evangelical community and become a teacher, shows her growing awareness and engagement in resistance, which encompasses providing and conserving clean water supplies, mapping territories, and educational programs that center on women and young people. Quote, when women have a seat at the table representing their communities and their peoples, everything's different, she says. It was during this time that she met Anderson, who had been living in the rainforest since 2011 and had become increasingly involved in environmental protest. When I asked them to talk a little about how their relationship developed, our language gap is no barrier to me understanding their laughter. Anderson takes up the story, quote, when she told her father and her mother that she had met me and that we were in love and that we were building an alliance together to unite the communities and the peoples against the oil industry, her father was very curious to meet me. He asked questions like, but how is a white man going to be able to walk in the forest? Will he complain all the time? Will he ever learn how to hunt animals? If you're going to have kids, how are they going to learn? How are they going to get fed? Nkwema's mother, who specializes in making medicines, worried that he would arrive and promptly get bitten by a snake. Luckily, Anderson's first trip to meet his future family allayed their fears. Quote, my father said, he's very strong and he's going to be able to carry all the wild meat back to the house before he learns how to hunt. He can pack a lot of the boar on his back, so that's good. He's got strong legs. Anderson chips in, quote, and they liked that I laughed a lot and I liked telling stories and I didn't complain about anything in the forest. That's really important for the Wairani. Nkwema is highly attuned to the existential threats to those living in the rainforest and is quick to point out they are visible far beyond the high-impact weather events that make big news stories. Quote, for my elders and for indigenous peoples across the Amazon, we don't need huge, devastating storms, biblical floods, years-long droughts to notice changes. Our people see and observe small changes before the big weather events that cause headlines and grab attention for people in the cities around the world. Quote, for instance, just the other day, speaking with my dad, he told me there's a specific fruit tree that should be fruiting right now in the forest, and it isn't. That tree is what provides food for the squirrel monkeys, for the turkeys, and the curassows, and for a lot of different animals in the forest. So now the monkeys are arriving, and all they're seeing are the leaves of the tree, and they aren't happy, and they're going into our gardens to eat fruits that are not for them, papayas and plantains. My father also told me he's noticing that the river turtles are not laying eggs on the beaches as they should right now. Recently, intense river flooding has destroyed crops of yucca and plantain, wiping out sources of carbohydrates for at least the next 9 months. Nanquimo and Anderson, who have two children, their daughter Deme's birth is chronicled in the book, and a son, Soul, followed, have a vast task ahead of them and appropriately ambitious plans to match. Over the next few years, their attention is focused on continuing their 13-year fight on the front lines of the Amazon, building clean water and solar energy projects, installing high-frequency radio communication systems, and expanding a network of monitoring programs. They also are focused on the movement to return land to those who have lived on it and cared for it for generations, territory that extends to 10 acres that are beset by ceaseless threats from governments and corporations. That's 10 million acres, beset by ceaseless threats from governments and corporations. Quote, across the Amazon, indigenous peoples are the customary owners, said Anderson. Quote, maybe they don't have land titles, but they're the traditional owners of about half the Amazon rainforest. If the forest is forsaken, he believes, there are no prospect of averting climate catastrophe, and to protect it, allies are needed. Indigenous folks can't do this alone. They've been swimming upstream against an unrelenting tide of conquest and threats for hundreds of years. And now there is this amazing alignment of urgency and interest and energy where the climate crisis is real. Threats are growing every day, and there's more and more recognition around the world of indigenous people's leadership on climate, their stewardship, the importance of indigenous people's protection of their lands and of biodiversity. Nanquimo is equally clear. Quote, if we continue on this path of little by little destroying forests, destroying rivers, destroying air, the consequences are going to be full for humans and cultures around the world, all forms of life. It's going to be awful, and I want people to wake up. We will not be saved, a memoir of hope and resistance in the Amazon by Nepante Nanquimo, and it was published by Headline. And again, this was from The Guardian early last summer, and I just felt that was a very important message, you know, just not for the rainforest, for all of us. But what really gives me hope, we have a young intern here at KMUD, and she's a teenager. And we all, you know, women were asked to do a 2-minute piece for Women's History Month. It's, you know, different ones are going to play all month, 2 minutes long, you know, of some, you know, a woman you honor. And a lot of people, you know, did the women they like. I did, you know, Indigenous women in general. But Gage, our young intern, she did hers on Mother Earth. To her, that was the most important and is the most important woman. So that really gives me hope when the young people really understand.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
I thought I'd share this story with you. It really was gut-wrenching to read because it's about a 17-year-old suicide victim that was hauled through the Alaska village on a sled by police. And this is by Levi Rickett, the editor of Native News Online. And he says, Alaska natives in Uquikvik, formerly known as Barrow, expressed outrage after a video surfaced on social media showing police hauling the body of a 17-year-old through the streets of the village located on Barrow point north of the Arctic Circle. The video, posted by his sister Zoe Vasquez Adams, captures the body of Christian Vasquez, a suicide victim, being pulled on a sled behind a police car while another police vehicle with emergency lights followed closely behind. Vasquez Adams shared the footage to highlight what she described as the mistreatment of residents in their small village and to question the actions of the officers involved. With the video, she posted a statement on Facebook that reads, quote, "I'm posting this video to raise awareness. This is how we're treated in this small village. Nobody cares about us because we are Native, and this is an ongoing issue, suicide, with what my family has gone through today. I wouldn't wish this upon anyone. Here is a video of my deceased brother. I have no respect for this community whatsoever, so I will never forgive anyone for this. I've posted this video before, but people told me that nobody deserves to see this. This is my baby brother. So beep you and your piece of beep village. Yes, I had a complaint. The only thing I had received was, quote, an apology for the circumstances. Let me know who I can reach out to. This will never sit right with me. My poor baby brother will forever be 17. Vasquez Adams told the Anchorage Daily News that she had been searching for her brother Wednesday morning after he left the house upset. They had been talking about getting him help. He hugged her and told her that he loved her. Within hours of the video being posted, North Slope Borough Mayor Josiah Patkotak released a statement addressing what he referred to as the Ageek Street incident, named after the road where it took place. Quote, "First, we offer our prayers to the families who have lost their loved one. No one, no matter the circumstances, deserves the type of treatment that unfolded soon after." Patkotak's statement reads, quote, "As mayor, I take full responsibility and I'm working to swiftly review and address the situation and will take appropriate action. We are all disheartened by the poor judgment exercised in how to respond to such a devastating situation." Patkotak began an investigation on Wednesday to find out why Christian's body was treated with disrespect and put on public display. The police attempted to justify its actions by saying the officers used a sled for their safety because the gun Christian used to take his life was frozen inside his hand when he was discovered. The mayor updated the public on Thursday by saying, while, quote, "challenging terrain and weather conditions initially required the use of an all-terrain vehicle," quote, "there was a critical lapse in judgment for further transportation on the road system to the hospital. There are no excuses for the way the situation was handled in such a rushed manner." The supervising officer was released from employment on Thursday. Suicide is a major crisis in Indian country, and according to the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, Native Americans experience higher rates of suicide compared to all other racial and ethnic groups in the United States. Suicide is the eighth leading cause of death for American Indians and Alaska Natives across all ages. Native youth suicide rate is 2.5 times higher than the overall national average, making these rates the highest across all ethnic and racial groups. I can't imagine the family was already hurting from what happened. And to do that, and with all the racist stuff that's going on, being led by 47, people just think they can get away with anything. Yeah, let's just fire every person of color. I was reading this statement by this black woman doctor, and she said, "I went to the same medical schools as them, took the same test, did the same residency, and I became a doctor. It has nothing to do with the color of my skin. It has to do with my passion for wanting to help people. But she lost her job. But they're doing the education right now. And to the Indian colleges, the Native colleges, Haskell in Kansas is sitting on the edge of their seat. They've lost a lot of funding. What are they going to do? And so much of that is guaranteed under treaties. I'll be back next week.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.